I hope you found something to refresh you. So I've got like about an hour and a half of, I'll try and keep it, try and even come in underneath that, but the second half of this particular session is going to be about tombstoning, which I will go into quite some detail. I've already had some questions in the break about it, so it's a very important topic, and it will keep cropping up during this next bit. But the first part of this next section, I want to talk about some of the kind of interesting, cool stuff that you can do in terms of integrating with the phone, Bing Maps, location service, the pivot and the panorama controls, and how you use those. So I'm going to first about talk about launchers and choosers. So one key thing about the phone, about Windows Phone 7, is that it's your apps operate in a very controlled environment. They run in a sandbox. You can't get direct access to the file system. You have a file structured file system in isolated storage, but it's just for your app. If you want to communicate with another app on the phone, the only way you can do that is for both of them to call out to the same web service, and actually you go out via the internet. So there's no inter-process communication stuff. So this all sounds scary to us Windows Mobile devs who were used to doing all sorts of wacky stuff in memory process queues and all this kind of thing. And you can still do that in embedded. But on the phone, it's a very, very tightly controlled environment. And the reason for that is because the number one deliverable of Windows Phone 7 is good user experience. Everything else is subservient to that goal. And part of that is that the way that you can interact with things on the phone is actually controlled. And it's controlled by these special APIs called launchers and choosers. So it allows your applications indirect access to things like the contacts list, or to make a phone call, or to send an SMS. And the bottom point there is invokes distinct built-in applications. So what will happen if there's a search launcher? You can launch the Bing search engine from within your application. And what actually will happen then is that you will start up the built-in Bing Maps search application on the phone. So and that will actually replace your app until such time as they hit the back key, and then they would come back to the previously focused application, which would be yours, of course. So a launcher is, there's these two classes, why they're described slightly differently. They both do the same thing. They both start something else off. But launchers don't actually do anything and don't actually return anything to your application. So you set them off doing something, send them off to a marketplace or something, or make a phone call. But there's no actual data that's going to be returned back to your application associated with that. So that's a launcher. A chooser does the same thing, but in this case, it's off, you know, pick a contact, so you'll get some context back, so you get some information about the user that they've selected, or take a photo, and of course you'll get the photo stream, the JPEG stream data coming back if they've taken a photo. So it'll call out, it'll run the built-in application. The user will either complete the task or they will cancel out of it, as is their right. But either way, you'll get an event handler will fire in your application, and you'll get information about whether the task completed or okay, or whether the user cancelled it. And then if it's okay, you've got the data that's associated with it. So this is the current list in V1. As you can see, you can switch over to ask them to create an email. Lots of ones about marketplace. So this is quite useful in your apps when you're obviously, you want to point them at maybe other great apps you've also created. So on your about page, you might well have a link that will sort of say, you know, see other apps by this publisher. And you can actually then send them off to the marketplace hub and give them a filtered search with just showing all your other apps in the marketplace, that kind of thing. So you can send them to the detail about an app or hub. They can review your app, which is part of the important thing about any app store, is that the best selected, the best reviewed apps will tend to get more profile in the marketplace. So you want to have good reviews, of course. Search and launcher. They can make a phone call. They can go off and do the Bing search engine. They can send an SMS. Or they can launch the web browser. There's also a web browser control, so you can embed a web browser functionality in your app as part of your UI, but this is different. This is actually launch the built-in browser, the Internet Explorer browser. The choosers, You can often get, they can go and take a picture and you'll get the stream back. You can then do whatever you want with that data, that image picture stream. You could save it to the general pictures media hub on the phone, so it just becomes one of the regular pictures stored on their phone. Or you can use it for your own purposes within the app. So you can do fun things like take a photograph of the user and kind of embed that in an avatar for a game or something like that. You can go off and look in the contacts list and get an email address back. Again, you can go off and look in the list and get a phone number. You can go and look at all the photos on the. You can send them off to the built-in photo application, so they could select an existing photo on the application. And then you can actually, the rather limited way that you can create contacts is rather more limited than in Windows Mobile days. You can actually save an email address and save a phone number. It's fairly limited what you can do, but that does divert them to the UI. The user can then add other contextual information for a contact, but that's the way you actually invoke that functionality. So programming them is a launcher. This is the one that doesn't return any data. It's dead simple. Just create a new instance of, they're all called something task, so just create a new instance of the appropriate class. Set some whatever properties on it are exposed that are relevant to that task. And then once you've set up the object, you just call the show, and at the point it goes show, that's where it goes off and invokes that external application. And down there's a bottom example of doing that for the marketplace. So choosers, though, these return data. Now, there's fairly complex rules associated with using choosers that you must follow for reasons I will explain over the next few slides. But essentially, you must declare the task object as the object must be declared as a field in your page. Okay, that's the first thing. And then in your constructor, you would new up that object. And then also in the constructor, that's where you would hook up the completed event handler and point it at the code you want to run when the completed event comes back into your application. And then obviously you need to write your code for that completed event. And then obviously at some point, whenever in your application logic, when they press a button or whatever is appropriate for your application, then when you're ready to actually invoke this launcher, you call the show task, this method, the same way as you would with a launcher. So these are the rules. It must be declared with class scope, and you've got to new it up in the constructor. So here's a simple example of the photo chooser. So there we go, we've got our main page class, and the first thing we do is declare a photo chooser task object as a field. In the constructor, we new it up, and then we hook up the completed event handler, and then the actual logic for the completed event handler is down at the bottom there, and then at some point in your class, on a button one click in this case, you call the show method. So, simple enough, and they all work the same way. And here's an example using the camera capture task, which does actually work in the emulator, oddly enough. What it does is it seems to rotate a white square around a black background at random, and then when you hit the photo, you just end up with the white square in a different position. So it's still good enough for testing. And then you actually get a photo result object back in the completed event for that one. So one of the things you get in there is the chosen photo, which is a data stream of the image data. So let's actually go and do some of that. All right. So this sample application, let's run it in the emulator. Just has a simple main screen with a number of options on it, so you can just exercise each of these launchers and choosers. First time you boot the emulator, it's a bit slow. So a number of different things in here, one of them is you can actually save a same phone number thing. So there's a save contact info where you can put in a phone number. And there's an example here of the phone keypad coming up. And we can put stuff, we can put something in here and hit save phone number. And there's actually some logic already on this, so it's not going to let us get away with anything. So we have to put 1, 2, 3. I think that's good enough. No, what does it want? It wants another digit. Okay, 4. And save phone number. And then it goes off to the contacts list. If I go and look at what's going on here. So this is the XAML page that we were just in. There's the input scope, which is the shorthand way of doing what I showed you with the long bit of XAML before, to invoke the right keyboard to come up. And in the code behind for this guy, that's how that validation was doing. We've actually got a regular expression there to make sure that they enter validator. So there's a lot of good stuff in this. And then we've got our save phone number task declared up here. We knew it up in the constructor. Here's our event handler. And then here we've got to the show bit. We've invoked the task, which is why we're currently here, which is the built-in phone contacts list. So we can choose to select a somebody on there, and the thing completely crashed. There you go. Try that again. Select a user. There we go. Well, what's meant to happen is in the event handler, save phone number task completed, it should come into here. So that was great, wasn't it? Let's try a different one. The search page. So this is just a simple launcher. So these are really, really simple. You don't even have to declare these as a field. And just switches straight to the Bing search engine. So we can search for Windows space phone. And hit that. And it'll go off and invoke the search engine. But that one isn't implemented. Sorry, that's the button. There we go. So they're invoking the search task back on the phone. This is, of course, we've just booted it. You always get this standard privacy thing. So we say, yeah, we can allow that to do that. And it'll go off on to actually out on the web and bring back some suitable results. Buy a phone. Not yet. Buy a Windows mobile phone, but not yet. Windows phone. Now, there's an interesting thing about this, about the execution model. Now, this is a little preview of the second half of this talk, okay? So, one thing about that's interesting about this, some commentators have pointed out, actually, this is what the iPhone used to do, which it doesn't do anymore since iPhone 4 came along. And no doubt at some point, some version down the line, Microsoft will change the way this works. But at the moment, only one third-party app is allowed to run at any one time. So, and this is for performance reasons. It's for maintaining a really, really great user experience for your user. This does actually cause some interesting side effects for you as an app developer. So what happens whenever your app does that show method and goes off and launches one of these other applications, your application is terminated, is actually deactivated. There's a subtlety here. Now, if your user is in an app, and this is a preview I'm going to come on to in much more detail. If your user is in your app and then they suddenly think, oh, do you know, I really want to go off and finish that Sudoku game I was doing. So they've got bored with your app. And this is the way with phones. Obviously, people's interaction, you know, they just, it's an instant gratification thing. You know, you do this and then you do that. Oh, I need to send an email. Oh, yeah, maybe I'll ring this person. Oh, I'm going to send an SMS. Or you get a message coming in. So interruptions are going on all the time. So as soon as your app loses focus, so they switch to something else, maybe they hit the center button, the Windows button on the center, and it brings up the menu, and then they select some other task, as soon as they switch to something else, your app is killed. It's not running. It's not running in the background. It's terminated. The system does save state, and there are ways for you to, and what you as an app developer must do at some point in the future, your user may come back to your app. So they've gone off, they've done whatever it was they were doing, they've finished sending their SMS, they've finally cracked that Sudoku they've been working on for the last 3 weeks. And then they hit the back key, and your app then pops up to the top of the history stack again, and it gets reactivated. And you can, your task as a developer is then to restore your app to exactly the same state it was as when they left it. So the illusion, the illusion is that it doesn't die. But in actual fact, while they're away doing other stuff, it's not running. Now, with launchers and choosers, that's true as well, of course, with this caveat. So you must assume that when they go off and run a launcher or chooser, when they come back and your app is killed, and then when it comes back, it'll be the same restart logic that I'm going to go into in about 15, 20 minutes' time in detail. So it will be killed. Now, the reason why I'm mentioning is this: there's a kind of a weird sequence of events that fires. So when an app comes back from tombstoning, a couple of things happen. It will come back. It will run the constructor on your app class, the app.xaml.cs class. That gets run. There's various events that get fired in the app. There's an application activated event, and I'll go into those in a minute. And then on the page that they were on, the system remembers what page they were on. So if you were on my second page.xaml, that's the one that will be rebuilt. So the constructor on that page will usually run. And then the onNavigated2 event fires. And the onNavigated2 event always fires whenever, in whichever way you go to a page. So that's a given. An onNavigated2 event will fire. And that happens when you come back from tombstoning, just the same as if they've navigated through the normal use of your app. So onNavigated2 will fire. But with launchers and choosers, it doesn't always totally kill your app. It could be sort of suspended in stasis. So the method invocation order is that you get the application activated when it's returning from a tombstone. You either get the page constructor will fire, then your chooser delegate, so your completed event handler, will fire. But that happens before the onNavigated2 event handler fires on the page. So just this is something that's going to trip people up. The simple message is don't put anything in your completed event handler that relies on any logic that you might run in onNavigated2 or in the constructor, because onNavigated2 will happen after the event handler fires, and actually the constructor may not fire at all if the application has been just kind of paused rather than actually killed. So, and this pausing is something that only happens with launchers and choosers. So what I'm going to come on to later is a little bit simpler. So here's an example when your app is completely tombstoned. The app is, this is a sequence of what happens. So on the left hand we've got the app object, and then in the middle is the particular page that you're on, so main page or whatever, and then there's the object is the actual task object. So this is a life cycle. So time starts from the top and moves down. So you can see the normal course of things is your application constructor will run, then there's a launching event will fire, and then in the particular page you get the page constructor, And then your event handler, then inside the construct of your page, you're going to initialize new up the task. So that's the photo chooser task constructor. Then you're on navigated to event on the page fires. And then at some point later on, you know, your app's running and this sort of thing, then on some button or whatever in your application logic, you're going to call the show method on that chooser. So that's happening there with the application involves the chooser. And then the app sort of unwinds and dies and it switches over and it runs your launcher and chooser logic, like with a photo. And then from the yellow star, it comes back. And then your application is brought back to life again because they finished with the launcher chooser, the photo chooser application. And now your application is being brought back to life. So your app constructor will run, your activated event fires, and back on the page, again, your page constructor will fire, your photo chooser task will fire. Then you get the completed event handler, and only after that do you get the on-navigated to. So this is going to trip a few people up. It's rather complicated. And in certain circumstances, and this is the one exception to the rule, your app will be suspended but not actually killed. So the only difference from the previous slide that I showed you is that the constructors don't run. So these are the two variants you will see, and just be aware of this when you're programming these things. It's going to catch out a lot of people. So hopefully that will make a bit more sense in about half an hour's time. So that was a bit heavy, but essentially they're easy to use, apart from that, making sure your logic it runs at the right time. So what about location services? So we have this built-in location service, which is really nice. We've just been creating an app called Where Is My Car, which is going to be one of the apps that's going to be featured during the launch, which a trivially simple application. Basically, you park your car in a big airport car park or Marks and Spencer's at Warrington, where I would lose my car, huge, one of these, or IKEA, or some of these huge car parks, And maybe you think you're a person who has trouble remembering where your car, or a huge multi-story, that sort of thing. So when you park your car, you just press a button in the app, and it will use the location services to figure out where you are. And then it will use the big map services to draw a map, and then you can also take a photograph, or you can take a voice recording, and you can enter data. And this trivially simple app is absolutely enormous by the time you've done all that. It's been fun to write. But the location service is a key part of that. So location sources, and this is one thing they've done. Anybody who's done Windows Mobile with GPS, or even earlier than that, will know that actually getting data out, it wasn't too hard, but there were endless variants, as there always was with Windows Mobile. And you couldn't do any of this cell tower triangulation sort of stuff or any of this other kind of less precise location. But there are actually, in order to locate a phone, there are actually three ways of doing it. First is all of these devices have a built-in GPS chip in them, so they can talk to GPS satellites and figure out through that. But of course for that, and it's highly accurate, but it uses a lot of battery power. It's not particularly quick. So it can take anything up to a minute to get a good fix, or longer sometimes, and doesn't work indoors at all. So that's limitations, but if you want a highly accurate fix and you're outside, that's pretty cool. Less accurate, but very available, is cell towers, and that one is not as accurate. So actually, in the city, it's not too bad. You're going to get 100 meters accuracy, because there's a lot of... a lot of cell towers. There's a lot of antennas around, and it just does it by because a phone is connected always to more than one mast, so it can figure out where it is with a bit of basic trigonometry. So the cell towers is a plus for power. Doesn't use much of the battery power on the device. It's very quick, but again, if you're not in a city, the accuracy is not great. So again, where I live out in North Wales, you're looking at a 3 kilometre sort of accuracy from cell tower triangulation, which is not really much use certainly not for precise positioning. And lastly, if you're connected to Wi-Fi, again, they can do clever stuff with Wi-Fi positioning. So that one's kind of in the middle of the other two. So it's quite accurate depending on how many points there are and power and speed, as you can see. So different choices, but the good thing is you don't have to care very much because Microsoft will provide you one API to allow you to get your location from whatever location sources are available. So here's the code sample of how you do that. Here's the it's a geo-coordinate watcher object, and you just instantiate one of these guys, and in the constructor you can say there's only two choices: geoposition accuracy dot high, which means basically use the GPS, and geoposition accuracy dot default, which means use anything else if you can, you know. So if you want the cell tower, use default or Wi-Fi. There's a movement threshold, which is quite nice, which means basically it will only fire a position changed event if it calculates that the movement has changed more than the specified amount, and this is in meters, from the previous one. So you don't get these loads of events firing on minute little changes. So that makes it less chatty, which is quite nice. And then you just hook up a couple of events. There's a position changed event, and there's a status changed event. So a status change is things like initializing, or I'm not getting any data, I'm active, this kind of stuff. And then it just fires position changed events. So you get this geo-coordinate object, which is quite a rich object, has your lat long and vertical accuracy and horizontal accuracy and this kind of thing. So one call, hook an event, where you go. But always bear in mind that it's, especially with the GPS, it can be quite expensive on the battery. So you want to use these tools wisely. And one interesting side effect of it is, if you only want to use the GPS chip, you still need a live network connection, because it's a cloud-based service, which is kind of odd. You know, I think if you only want to use the built-in hardware, you shouldn't need that. But anyway, that's how it is. You can actually use this on the emulator. There's some, I don't know how, if any of you sort of read all the MSTN stuff, you know, the magazine. Every so often there's this frightfully clever stuff that comes in and boggles your brain, and reactive extensions is one of those things. I'll get the thumbs up over there, he knows what I mean. It's very clever stuff. Essentially, it's you can turn a sequence of events, you can hook up to event handlers, and it produces a sequence then, an observable sequence, so you can sort of data bind to it and this sort of thing. And you can use link statements on it and combine different events from different sources and in very, very, very clever ways. It's clever stuff, and there is a sample on the Windows Phone Developer website which uses reactive extensions to emulate a GPS. So you can... The sample that's on there just generates random lat longs, but you can equally just supply your own file of lat long data that you've collected yourself. And again, the sample is very good because it allows you to go out with a real phone and a real GPS and actually save some data. So this could be useful as well for doing like in Where's My Car. We've actually got a demo mode, so people can download it and install it for nothing and try it out. So the demo mode actually has a built-in root, which is a file of lat longs that we collected. Well, actually, I collected. So you get a nice animation. You get the map, and you were actually walking up my road. So if you get the demo version of that, you find out where I live. This could be a mistake. I should have known this. Anyway. And Bing Maps is cool. So have any of you done any Bing Maps on the web, Silverlight? Up there at the back. Well, you'll be happy because this is just the same. It's the same control, actually, and you program it exactly the same way. So full parity with the Silverlight Bing Map control, but it is optimized for Windows Phone. So it's touch enabled, so you can, you know, pinch and stretch to zoom in and out. Because the obviously the standard Silverlight control, you tend to get this UI on it that's optimized for the mouse. So you can click up and down to zoom in and out, and then you can pan left and right, this sort of thing, which is fine. And then you can that's actually obviously disabled by default. It wouldn't make much sense on the phone. You could actually turn it on if you wished, but it wouldn't be any sense because you couldn't focus with the finger on that. So optimize for the phone. And the simple way of showing that is just to do it. So, come on. So Visual Studio doesn't want to die. It's probably because I'm off in a... This is an interesting thing about launchers and choosers and about suspension. There's actually Visual Studio keeps running even though you've gone off to run a launcher and chooser. And, you know, as far as to all intents and purposes, you're looking at Visual Studio and it's still running, so you think your app is still running, and actually on the phone it's not. Which is, and in the beta, it did actually, Visual Studio, your session died. And then when it came back, you used to have like 5 seconds to actually restart your Visual Studio debugging session, and then it would reattach to the app, which was kind of a pain, which is why they stopped doing it. But at least it used to really drill home the message that actually your app was dying in the meantime, which is kind of... So I'm not sure that this is necessarily a great thing. Anyway, it's what we've got. So, okay. Go find it. So we've got a main page here with actually nothing on it. So the first thing I'm going to do is just drag in a map. Drop it on there. As you can see, not very helpful size at the minute, so I'm just going to get rid of the height and the width so it will automatically fill that, and change the name of that. So we've already got a map without having to do very much. I could even run it. And it will start up on the emulator. We've got our app bar with various buttons on it. And by default, it does zoom level of 1, which means the world. And it's centered on 0, 0, lat long. But if you can see that, you get this invalid credential, sign up for a developer account. So if you want to use this control, you do have to go off to the Bing Maps portal, which is here. I'm signed in as myself at the moment. Where's my keys? Create or view keys. So you have to register for your own kind of GUID, and you can put your name in here, you know, my great app or whatever. You give it a URL, which is simply it's not important, it's just a unique identifier, so probably your own company, you know, your own URL or whatever. And then in here you can select mobile, and then you can hit create key, and it will generate a key for you. And it is free at the moment, which is very nice. It's free for Windows Phone 7, so that's really good. And then you actually end up with these big, long... I'm going to copy and use that one. Big, long GUIDs that are registered with the portal and will allow you to use it in your application. So... I'm going to go back to my app. And good practice is just to store it in as in your app class, which is a kind of global repository for everything in your application. So I can... kind of like that. Change are not allowed to code running in the .NET compact framework. This is still the compact framework, folks. So Windows Mobile people will feel comfortable. So... external const string ID... is equal to our key. Stick that in there, so we've got it for use thereafter. And then over in my class, in my code behind, I'm going to. Create me a field, private read only, and the object that the map wants is this thing called a credentials provider. So I'm going to fix up the thing. Microsoft.phone.control. By the way, when I dragged the map control onto it, it automatically added Microsoft.phone.controls.maps and possibly that interop assembly into the references. So it did that automatically when I did that in the designer. And shills provider is equal to a new application ID credentials provider. And one of the versions of that, I can actually get the ID that I just created in my app class. So stick that in there. And then, well, I'm going to just wrap that in a property, use the refactor, encapsulate field as credentials provider. So that makes it a public property on this class. Now, this sample, this application, is set up so that data binding is pointing at this class. So in the back in the XAML, I can then go and actually find my map control here and do set the credentials provider to binding, and then the property that I just created, which is credentials provider. I have to spell it right, otherwise it won't find it. Credentials provider. That's about right. And so once we've got our ID, that thing should disappear. And for free, you get all the pinch and stretch, which I can't show in the emulator, of course, but you can double-click and zoom in. Zoom in, and we can, you know, pan it around and this sort of thing. We can pan it around. Yeah, there we go. So I can keep zooming in and zooming in until we find ourselves, but I'm not going to bother. So you get a load of functionality for free, bearing in mind, of course, that this is a network-bound control. So great performance on a fast network like this. And on Wi-Fi is good, on the phone, and on 3G, if you've got a good, strong signal, is pretty good. If you're on a poor quality network like GPRS, you're obviously not going to get this kind of interactivity out of it. So this, as I'm sure you've picked up from the splash screen, is part of the developer training kit, which is available through the Windows Phone developer website, which is a load of labs, including a really, really in-depth one on the Bing Maps here. So it goes on to show we implement this menu button to center on your current location, so you can use the location service for that. In fact, the lab hard codes a location, but you can center on it, and then you can also go off and you can put push pins on it. You can customize push pins. So that was when we were building Where's My Car, I wanted a custom push pin. So a normal push pin is just like a black flag thing, and I wanted a custom push pin. And there's all sorts of, if you go and use your favourite search engine to find out how to do a custom push pin, there's all sorts of advice out there, most of which is wrong. So follow the advice that's in this lab, because actually a push pin object is a standard Silverlight content control. So therefore it is templatable. You can customise it to death. You can go into Blender, you can create your custom push pins in there. It's very, very easy. But actually, when I was searching for how to do this, that message wasn't coming through. So just be aware of what you read. You know, we know what it's like out there. All this advice freely given, some of which is correct. So that's the built-in control, but this lab goes on to this button down here. Allows you to put in routing as well. So there's a number of Bing web services that sort of sit alongside this, which allow you to do things like... Now, there is a Civic Resolver class built into here, which allows you to take a lat long, and it will go off and find out the actual address of where you are. In the beta, that wasn't working. I think it's still implemented. I think they've got that working now. But if not, you can call the web service directly, and it's all that was doing is wrapping that web service. Anyway, you can do your from and to location. You can get a route back, and you can do the routing and draw all that on the. And if you follow this lab, it's actually surprisingly easy to achieve all that sort of thing. So it's a very powerful control. Now, there's the pivot control. So a key experience on the phone is this idea of the window, the screen just simply being a window on something much wider. And there are sort of visual clues or cues to the user that if they simply swipe their finger left or right, they're going to see more information. So this is an example of, there are two controls built in, and these were added right at the end. These are two controls that give you this kind of behavior. There's the pivot, which this example, this one is often trotted out as an example of what a pivot can do. But it's, for my mind, it's not. It gives the wrong impression that actually every panel has to be the same. This happens to be a weather app. So you can see the weather in Seattle, London, and you can see that Seattle is highlighted on the first one, and then London is greyed out. So this is kind of a clue to them that if they simply scroll across and swipe their finger, then they're going to see the weather for London, and then Paris and New York, and then it goes round again. But actually, each panel can be completely different XAML. It doesn't have to be the same. So it's just they're different views, different panes on related data, so you know, that's relevant to your application. And all that swipey stuff you get for free. It's all built into the control, and all the animations with it, it nicely locks into place, and you know, you just swipe and it's fast and then slows down. So all that for nothing, which is great. So you get these different app views, and it's optimized. You're usually limited to 7 views. Actually, that's kind of convention. There's no technical reasons why that would be the case. To use them is trivial. So you have an outer control, which is your pivot, and inside that you have one or more pivot items, and a pivot item is just another one of these, another container control, so you can put whatever you wish, whatever XAML you want in there, whichever controls you want in there to create the UI that you want for this. And for the gentleman who asked me about differences from Silverlight 3, of course these are unique to the phone, these pivot and the panorama controls, so they're unique to this kind of user interaction that is both finger-oriented and makes really good use of this of the screen size. I'm not going to show that, because I'm going to move on and talk about the panorama instead. So the panorama, the nice way of describing this is a bit like a magazine cover. So you're seeing a big area. You actually get a background graphic that extends across the whole thing. And then it's a bit like sort of looking at a magazine cover, and sort of inside on page 14 we got this, and oh, switch, go to page 73 for our latest bit on this, and oh, see photos of whatever. So you're seeing different views on things, but the background is it's a coherent whole. This background image spreads across it all, and yet again you've got the nice swipey stuff left to right, so you can go get to the different bits of it. And the classic example where this is used on the phone is both in the Games Hub, is an example here, and also in the Zune Music Player Hub as well. So you get the whole Zune experience as this big background, and then you can obviously, what actually has is the pivot. You've got a pivot overlaying a panorama. So once you drill into your music collection, then it switches to a pivot, and then you get the usual different views on the same data, where you can filter your music collection by album, by artist, by song. So those are different pivot views on it. So the two work quite well together on that one. So horizontal canvas, you get all the animations and everything are built in for free. Again, it says usually limited to 4 views, but that's just from a usability point of view, because you have got to supply this big graphic that sits behind it all. From a coding point of view, very similar to the pivot. Because of the time, I'll happily show an example of the pivot and the panorama in an app. Anybody wants to grab me any time the rest of the day, but I want to make sure we get to lunch on time. So, it's a bit small. It's the design guide. So you're enticing the user to explore, and it's a very physically interesting, exciting kind of UI. To compare the two, so the layout is simpler on a pivot, but the panorama is more visually stunning. So but in terms of how you program them, they're fairly simple. The pivot's kind of interesting from a programming point of view, because you get these loading pivot item and unloading pivot item events fired, which is one thing that's quite useful when you want to make sure that your app is highly performant. is that when your app starts up, you don't actually have to create all of your user controls, all of your UI. You could actually delay load it when actually a particular pivot item is about to be shown. You get this loading pivot item event fire, so you could then go off and instantiate a user control and plug it into the UI. So a good tool there for good performance. Some of the rules, there's a bit of confusion about which to use when, but one of the key things is if you think you need an app bar, you probably don't want to be using a panorama. So like I say, the panorama is just a big shop window, but your application logic shouldn't really be at that level. It should be once you've actually selected something and then gone into some your application logic, then that's the place for app bars and that kind of thing. So like I mentioned, the Zune one is a great example, in that at the top one, you've got the panorama, which is the visually exciting user experience that they get when they first go in there. But then once they've actually gone into their music, they've selected their particular music bit, then you're into pivots are ideal, because users are going to want to select, look at their music in different ways. So just by swiping across, you can switch between artists, albums, songs, playlists, and so on. Do not place a pivot inside a panorama, and never place a pivot inside a pivot, and don't use these things for doing kind of wizard steps. So there you are. These are the golden rules that have been established. So they should be used independently, really. No questions. Because we all want to get on and get to lunch. So that was a kind of lightning tour of the... What are we resuming? Kill? Right. That was the integrating with the phone. Now then. Now we get to the fun stuff. Raising the dead.